Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I want to thank you for spending your valuable time with me and my awesome guests each week. And that cut that you just hit a little tease of opening the show was by Diva Haley's Sacred Alchemy CD called Love, Lover, Beloved. Well, if you're new to the show, I'm your hostess, Karen Tate. I'm the author of the two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destination, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. So whether you're an armchair tourist or you actually get out there with boots on the ground, whether you're a solitary practitioner or you're part of a group looking for insight and ideas to live a goddess-inspired life, I invite you to check out my website at KarenTate.com. Learn more about my books, tours, workshops, Sacred Sunday services every fourth Sunday in North Hollywood. And while you're there, don't miss the free meditations. They're my gift to you, my listeners. And remember, please, a Blog Talk is not free to hosts, and contributions are welcome. I pay out of my pocket to give my guests a platform to teach and share their wisdom every week. So there are PayPal buttons on my Goddess Store page if you'd like to make a credit card contribution, or you can always send a check. You can email me about this or any other subject. I always love it when guests send me guest ideas, or when listeners send me guest ideas or things they'd like me to share on the air. My email address is KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. Well, tonight we have a provocative show for you. First up is Roar Shepherd talking about his book, The Universe Speaks, The Love and Pain of 2012 to 2015. He's going to detail his communication with universal or cosmic beings who have given him some insight into why we're having these natural disasters and upheavals in society. And he has the reason for all this dis-ease. Then after my chat with Roar, Trish McCannon is up, and she's done extensive research on Jesus for her book titled Jesus, The Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions. I know if you're like me, you've long considered Jesus one of the last dying and rising gods, as they have in the pagan religion. I've even considered he and Mary Magdalene clergy of the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. So we'll see what Trish has to say about that and much more. Because I think the Romans never had record of Jesus actually existing. Maybe she can clear up that mystery as well. But before we get to our first guest, Roar, I just have an announcement for you. I want to make sure you're aware of the upcoming third annual Healing Fair presented by Pagan Pride LA. That's going to be Sunday the 20th of May from 11 to 5, and the theme of this year's Healing Fair is Heal Yourself, Heal the World. It's going to be held at the Green Man on Lancashire Boulevard in North Hollywood. And it would be great if you could come support this fundraising event for Pagan Pride Day 2012. Some of the workshops are going to be a healer doing a workshop called A Hallowed Healer, Unwounded, Unwound, and Unbound. There's also going to be Julie James. She's going to be there talking about the plant medicine. There's going to be a live meditation. I'm actually giving a talk, too, on goddess ecology for a sustainable future. So if any of that sounds interesting, or if you'd just like to come down and meet some like-minded community, remember, mark your calendar, Sunday, May 20th, 11 to 5 at the Green Man Store. And as far as Voices of the Sacred Feminine goes, you can catch any show from the archives. So you can listen via iTunes. You can call in if you have questions for our guests at 718-766-4662. And if I see you on the switchboard, I'll get you a natural stopping point in our conversation, and I'll take your calls, and I'll identify you by your area code. So, without further delay, let me tell you a little bit about our first guest, Roar, and then we'll begin our chat. Well, Roar is an American, and he's been residing in Korea for about 15 years, where he studied Korean traditional culture and language. He's interested in the secrets of the universe. He's also searched for it through meditation. And through the deep silence of his meditations and breath training, he began to communicate with various beings through wavelengths. He's actively sharing with others the methods for a new society, which he says is coming sooner than we think. and also for preparation. The new society will be based on breathing and love for human beings, nature, and the universe, so we're going to delve into all of that. He's also studied Oriental medicine for 6 years. He's one of the few experts on the 8 body types, which is... we're all apparently a certain body type at birth according to the size of our organs, and we should eat differently, exercise differently, take medicine differently. If we have a chance, we might talk about that a little bit as well. But without further ado, Roar, welcome to the show. Hi, are you there, Roar? He was.
Can you hear me? Yes, thank you so much for having me on the show tonight.
Oh, hi. Here, there you are. So, Roar, let me start I'm not sure this has anything to do with your work necessarily, but maybe I'm wrong. Let me just ask you to get it out of the way. How did you get your name, Roar?
I come from hippie parents from San Francisco. they were watching the Winter Olympics in 1972. There was a Norwegian ice skater named Roar, which is a common name in Norway, R-O-H-R. They heard the name, they said, bingo, that's the name, we're going to give it to him, he's got to have that name, Roar. So it was hippie parents and a good-sounding name. But I tell you, when I was 5 years old, we visited an Indian reservation, and the Indian came over and he said, what is your name? And I said, Roar. And he said, what? And I said, Roar. And he said, ah, good name. So I felt I was blessed by the Indian chief.
There you go. Well, you know, I can't think of a better person than a child born to hippie parents that would have been open to messages from the universe. I mean, seriously. So,
I think that's part of the story.
So anyway, let's start at the top here. So you're in Korea. You're studying these breath techniques. You're meditating. How long was it before you started getting these communications from these beings, and who are these beings?
I was doing breath work for many years, over 10 years there, and while I was working on an eco-farm studying about wild plants and how to eat them and grow them, actually I began conversations with plants, and the weeds, the dandelions, and the rosemary started to talk to me, actually. And,
okay.
But not the plant itself. It was actually the representative spirit in the universe that I was able to speak with and speak about the kingdom and the law and how the plants feel about everything on the earth. And they started telling me these stories about the state of the earth, the state of Gaia, the state of the planet, and some changes that are going to happen.
Okay.
And then later on, other beings started to talk to me as well. And they said they were from Pleiades and other planets. And so when I started to put together their messages, at first it was very shocking and very unbelievable, but it turns out they all had very similar messages.
All right. Well, you know, I mean, some people might think this sounds really way out, but, you know, I mean, I know people who have been at the Findhorn Institute and stuff like that. I'm open-minded, you know. I believe practically anything is possible. So I'm an advocate for you here. But explain to me, how does this happen? I mean, is this like mental telepathy that you start getting, you know, they're communicating with you in that manner? Or, I mean, how did you receive the messages?
As you said, at Findhorn, they did the same thing. They were able to speak with the plants and ask them, communicate with them, what do they want and where do they want to be placed. And we have that ability to actually, originally in our DNA, to speak to plants and animals and to with the universe itself. It's in our DNA, and part of the breathing process is to resurrect that ESP inside of all of us, our original abilities. How it works is you sit down and you lower your wavelengths. In fact, a very high wavelength can only communicate with high wavelengths, and a low wavelength is the frequency of the universe. So if you lower your wavelength through breathing, you lower your consciousness, then you can tap into, just like tapping into the radio, you could tap into different frequencies. And in that state, if you ask a question, then the answer will come to you. And so it comes through mental telepathy, it comes through writing, and it comes through inspiration. It comes through knowing. You have to believe in it. So I don't hear a voice or something like that, but you know the message is right just by looking at what you've received.
Well, for a skeptic, how do you get over the skepticism? You know, how do you get past, you know, I'm just deluding myself, or, you know, I want to hear this, so maybe it's just my imagination. Okay.
I agree. At some level, it sounds unbelievable. In the East, especially where I come from in Korea, where we did breathing training, this is an aspect of the breathing training that's been done for thousands of years. So it's just one of the techniques they use. So it's based on belief. It's based on faith. It's based on knowing your breath, knowing the questions you receive, and then looking at the material you have. So just like the book I have, if you look through the material, you have a sense of the wave that's there, a sense of the inspiration that's coming through it. And it's a sense of, do I believe this or not believe this? So as I said, there are other people who I was training with who, you know, also receiving information, and it was very similar. So you come to believe it in that sense through the message itself.
Now, in your book, The Universe Speaks, Love and Pain of 2012 to 2025, do you teach the breathing techniques in there, or talk about how to do them, or is that something you learn, you know, someplace else?
Well, that's one of the main things I'm doing. I've been traveling the world, and I've finally returned to America after 15 years to get this breathing out there. This breathing is what they do in the East, and it's what a baby does. At birth, a baby breathes from below its belly button and its womb, the mother's womb and its own womb, and nature, the animals in nature breathe from this area as well. So it's our natural way of vibrating with the frequencies of the universe. You know, we have a device inside of all of us that connects to the frequencies of the universe, and that is possible through this breathing method. And I'm going out there, I'm teaching workshops about this now because it hasn't come to the West. And in the book, I let people know that it exists for the first time. It's called Danjun. In Chinese, they call it Tan Tien. So if you've done Tai Chi or something like that, they introduce you to the concept of breathing from there. But the actual breathing method isn't done for the body. It isn't done standing up. It's actually done lying down. So to actually go deeper into it, you actually need to find a deeper trainer. So we talk later about 2012, I can let you know that the Eastern method of preparation, the Western method of preparation for the changes that are coming are completely different. The Western is looking toward the just sort of as a physical preparation or just preparing with love, whereas the East is actually going to the fundamental and going to breathing, because some people talk about 2012, they say we're going to change our chakras and we're going to become semi-ethereal bodies. And the East says, well, that was already possible thousands of years ago, just through breathing. You didn't need a photon belt or a huge climactic event to make it happen, if this is making sense at all.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a lot I want to talk to you about, and so we'll go back to the breathing, but I'm really curious about the predictions. So these beings started to talk to you about what's happening on the planet and what we can expect. So I guess fill us in. What do we need to know that we don't, you know, what do we have wrong?
Well, I mean, if we look at what's happening in the world today, it's all pretty much straightforward that we're in a climate change situation and the Earth is changing, and everything is coming to sort of a titanic moment where everything is sort of coming to a changing point. We're seeing the end of sort of a civilization, an end of sort of an era. We're going into a new era. So you can see it in politics not going well and economics not going well. And you can see it in the climate change that is happening out there. You can see it from both sides any way you wish to see it. But in fact, natural disasters are increasing. And in a sort of a wider view, we're seeing it that the Earth itself is sick and it needs to cleanse itself, just as if you have the flu and you need to, you know, sort of cleanse your body. Then in the same situation, the Earth is sick and it needs to cleanse itself, so it has to purify itself, or A, because of all of the pollution it's received till now, and B, because of sort of a transformation that it's going to go through. So it's not really too hard to see that. I mean, there's so many people already talking about that now. Yesterday I was watching an interview on the television with Dron Valo, who does sacred geometry, and he's already stated that, you know, the Russian government is already preparing people for these natural disasters and even for something called a photon belt, and telling people when this happens that they have to sort of uplift their consciousness and be prepared to go through it.
Wow, they're saying that in Russia?
In Russia. So,
yeah, that's
and not
crazy.
Only Russia, but they got that information from NASA. NASA has also published this information recently about the photon belt that is coming, the change that is coming from, you know, interstellar, intergalactic light is much stronger than we think. And the reaction is going to be much stronger than we think. So NASA is already saying that. So this is not completely stalking news, shocking news. However, what they're saying is that no one's really either piecing the dots together or really internalizing it and thinking about what they can do.
Well, you know, I think the problem is, if you want to call it a problem, is no one really knows what to expect and everybody tells you something different. You know, I've had folks on the show. This isn't normally our topic. You know, every now and again we'll sort of go off topic and, you know, tonight's one of those nights in a sense. But, you know, some people are saying, well, you know, it's 2012 is really nothing more than just where the Mayan calendar stopped. You know, it didn't mean it was the end of anything or the beginning of anything. It just happened to be where they stopped. You know, other people are saying it's going to be a paradigm shift, and there's all sorts of ideas about what that could potentially look like. And I guess I'd say probably I assume most of my listeners, probably feel like, you know, they believe in climate change. You know, they can see the escalation of, you know, more storms out there, more chaos out there. I know some of us are thinking of it also in terms of, well, you know, maybe the planet is going to be better. We'll get away from this dominator society, and maybe we can shift into a more egalitarian sort of interconnected society. But are you getting specifics? You know, what are your messengers saying we should specifically look for, and when is it going to happen? You know, when will we start to see something beyond just the climate change?
Well, I mean, almost every religion now, almost every Buddhism, Taoism, Christianity, almost all of them have talked about this for a long time, or the spiritual teachings, or the channeling. So it's really not a big shock right now that, you know, it's the age of Aquarius where love comes. So a shift, a new civilization is set to come. And so I guess the question is sort of when and how, but that something is coming, a transformation is coming, shouldn't be such a big shock to people right now. So it should be a time where they internalize and think about, you know, how can I really love myself now? And do I really love myself? And do I really know myself? And what's the, you know, the cause of being said, you are so precious just for being born here right now. And do we really think we are that precious? And do we really think about why, what contract did we sign before we came here? Why did we decide to come here? So before we love the earth and love the planet and think about change, first we have to think, do I really love myself? Am I really taking care of myself? And then we see, okay, so some changes are happening out there. And in terms of disasters, I mean, you can't make adequate predictions about disasters. So in the book, there are some specific disasters about there, and I've gone over them again with the cosmic thing. So you were pretty specific, and I'm not sure about this now. And I said, look, these are just rough estimates of the type of the disasters that are going to happen. Don't look at so specifically that at this time or at this date and this magnitude will happen. But overall, you will see these kind of events happening to purify the earth. And if you just click onto earthquakes that are happening every day, the intensity, the magnitude is increasing every day, especially along the Pacific Rim. So the Pacific Rim is an area to watch.
Right. So I believe there were just some earthquakes yesterday, weren't there?
There's one in Mexico yesterday. There's one in Indonesia today. I mean, remember, even in the tsunami that hit India, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, 250,000 people died in that tsunami. So, you know, natural disasters are a huge thing that we have to think about. But we don't have to go into fear about them. Just know that the Earth is not in a good situation. Right. Obviously, if we're more enlightened, then we would spend time each day giving gratitude to the Earth, speaking to the Earth, sitting down, picking up the soil and saying, you know, I love you, soil, and try to have a conversation with it. See how it's feeling. See yourself. Ask yourself and have a conversation with your local dandelion plant and see how it's feeling itself. And spread a little love to that. And if 10 people do that and 100 people do that, then we have the power to reduce the purification process because we are healing the Earth. When your mother is sick, you go and you hug your mother and she feels better right away. Well, if the earth is not healthy, then we can hug the earth and hug the local plants and make her feel a little better to reduce that.
Well,
so,
I think that's a lovely idea, and I mean, I think that's something I'll you know, start suggesting to people as well. But you know, when you think about this, you know, the other type of character, you know, we have here, you know, in the United States, you know, people who are even denying that there's any climate change, people that would think this was just, you know, crazy nut job talk, you know, the kind of things we're talking about right now, you know, I guess it seems difficult to fathom that large swaths of Americans would be able to get on, you know, sort of get on the bandwagon here, you know. You know, they might think this was just crazy talk, you know. And so I guess what I'm asking you, and maybe you can't be more specific, I aside from climate changes, I mean, have you gotten any other sort of messages in terms of, you know, what we might expect, you know, going on in our societies around the world? I mean, is it, is life in the United States as we know it gonna change? And if so, how would you predict? I mean, was it predictions like that you got?
Well, the predictions I got that talked about sort of the changes that will happen in the next few years. So the next few years is a crucial time, especially, you know, this year. You know, the Mayan calendar just illustrates that there will be four meetings four alignments that will happen. And so that kind of shift is going to begin from the 22nd this year. But when the actual transformation will happen, the end of this year, starting into next year, you'll see that. And as we get closer to the coming or energy shifts that are happening, then you'll see shifts in society. You can see political shifts that will happen, economic shifts that will happen, transportation shifts, maybe perhaps peak oil or something. So you'll see these changes happen around us, and it'll force people to think about a new direction in community, a new direction in economics, a new direction in about life purpose. So people have to go inside and really think about these. And then we see a new future that's opening up, and the future is absolutely beautiful when they describe it, a new type of politics that we haven't imagined before. I'll just read you just if I can here.
Sure.
Says here, the future society will be as ideal as you can imagine. Diverse opinions and characteristics will be appreciated. All things will be judged by the evolution of the universe as well as the humankind. That is the first and foremost proposal. Thus, in a decision-making process, there won't be big conflicts or clashes. Every single person will be understood and embraced. The decision will be made by a small town, and finally, the entire planet will make a decision. So we see in the future a total shift of maybe the ideal lifestyle we've always wanted in terms of politics, in terms of love, in terms of technology, the most amazing technology that will come down, the most amazing different types of homes will go into community living. So this is also this whole transformation process will go up to 2025. It'll be complete. But the type of ideal society we've always dreamt about, it's coming in that sense, but we have to go through this hardship for a few years, and that's the process that people don't want to think about. This is the schedule. It's already scheduled from the universe that this shift will happen so that the whole entire universe will change. So everyone needs to realize that they came here to be a part of this process, and the future is going to be absolutely lovely, but it has to go through a purification process that all of us have to prepare for.
Well, you know, at this stage of things, I can barely think about anything besides keeping Republicans out of office. but you're talking about change way beyond that, and it sounds wonderful. I mean, it sounds like utopia, but it almost sounds too good to be true. You know, I can't imagine, you know, people who are supporting, you know, Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum, you know, suddenly getting on the bandwagon, and there'd be love and equality and, you know, all of these wonderful things, because, you know, or maybe the rapture will come and take them away and the rest of us can actually live like that. I don't know. but you know, it seems like there would be so much aversion to such change, because some of these people are so fear-based. I don't know, it's hard for me to visualize the kind of transformation that would, you know, that would be necessary, you know, for this actually to happen. And, you know, it's like somebody would have to come along with fairy dust, and, you know, we all wake up one morning with new enlightenment. But, you know, as much as I like to be an idealist, that seems hard to swallow, you know. I'm just wondering how does it happen?
Alyssa, you'll have to, I mean, NASA is talking about this, Russia is talking about this, there are many people talking about this. They're seeing in terms of a transformation, it's something called like a photon belt, but it's way out there. I agree, it's way out there, and it's something that we just sort of have to internalize and realize this is a possibility. I mean, NASA is talking about there are movements going on in the universe, and a photon belt is a high-level energy that comes and rushes across through the planet. It's like being in a microwave oven, and the radiation of a microwave and changes the essential essence of what is inside. And so a photon belt is a high-level energy that changes the components of our essence. And if you're resonating at a very pure level, then you can go through that. But if you're not radiating at a pure level, it's a very difficult process to get through that. I know that's a very difficult thing to contemplate, but NASA's already talking about this. This energy is coming at us now, and it's making the sun much more active. And so they're predicting solar flares. And these solar flares will come and perhaps knock out the energy grid lines around the world for a period of time, maybe 1 month, maybe 6 to 9 months. So if the energy grids are knocked out, then we don't get oil and we don't get energy. Then how do we run our heating system in our houses? How do we run our toilet system in our houses?
How do we run our computer?
What's that?
I said, how do we run our computer? Our social networks will break down.
That's just the point. I mean, this is something that you can say, I don't believe in all that, but the science is behind it. Just they said, look, we know that something like Katrina happened, and we prepared for it, but this is a Katrina that's coming from outer space, basically.
So if somebody wanted to Google this, Roar, what would they Google? NASA and
that,
what?
Just type in photon belt, PHOTON, and NASA.
Okay. So how has this changed you? I mean, I would imagine it has in some way. I mean, how does Roar walk through life knowing this stuff that other people don't know? You know, has it changed you in a profound way? I mean, how are you managing from day to day? How are you facing the future?
Well, I agree. At first, it was very hard. It was very strange to walk down the street saying, wow, if this is going to happen, then what's going to happen to my Starbucks? What's going to happen to all these things people are doing on the streets and their computers in this big city? And how will things shift and change? It was very hard to internalize it at first. And that's where the breathing was very, very helpful, to internalize this and to calm you down so that no matter what kind of emotional thing happens, you're able to deal with it. It's very difficult, especially in America. Actually, this message is very accepted around the world. As I travel and I show people the breathing and talk about what's coming, people are already preparing for it, talking about it. It's a heated discussion around the world. It is only in America where this discussion is hitting a rock wall. And I'm American, so I love my country, so I'm here, and I'm trying to find a way to share this. So the families aren't accepting it so well, and so it's a very hard message in America to grasp, because we're a very materialistic culture, and, you know, we love material. We've reached the prime of civilization and materialism. But with the cosmic beings said, there's a process of every planet. The first stage is learning about morals. The second stage is learning about material and how to use it, which we've mastered very well. But the next stage is to be able to let go of material, not be attached to it, to declutter ourselves from material, but then use that material for spiritual development. And that is what this new era, this new civilization we're going into is. It's happened before, though. We've read about Lumeria or Atlantis. This is not anything. It's happened in history before. So we've just reached that point, but we've become so attached to materialism that we've, you know, lost our understanding about our original spiritual abilities inside of us, that we can speak to plants or animals or even to the universe. And so we're just very far away from where we come from. We originally came from somewhere in the universe. We came here to do something, and we've lost our connection to that. So thinking about this is how I live my day, and sharing this with people one by one, and even if one person will awake to it, then that's a big awakening, I think.
So I want to go back to your conversations. So aside from what you've already shared, I guess I'm wondering, how does a conversation like that go? I mean, are you told sort of, I mean, I hate to use this cliche phrase, but the secrets of the universe, so to speak, you know? I mean, would be some of the most surprising things you've heard or been taught that you think might be interesting for listeners, aside from this change that's coming?
Well, as I said, they talk about how the future will look like, and they say just that it'll just be the most amazing, beautiful future you can imagine. So to me, it just motivates you. You know, when you realize that the type of politics you wanted, the type of relationships you wanted, the type of communities you wanted, and planets in the future that it doesn't have such egoistic, you know, desires that run the world, and it's not run just on competition, but it's run on love. And you know, so as you know, your focus is on the power of the goddess and women, and that's exactly it. Because in terms of universe energy, you know, they talk about the yin yang and the five elements. The era we're entering into is the era of earth energy, and earth energy means community and coming together and harmonizing and spirituality. But it also means we've ended the era of yang energy, which is male energy. We're entering into yin energy. And so yin energy now is rising, so you see more women in power, more women are dominant, more women have the energy. So, but the real meaning behind this is women have the power of mother's love. So the era we're ending into is women have to use their love that's inside them and tap into mother's love, which is the love of the universe, that absolute love. And I'll give you an example of when a mother has to find her child, she can pick up an entire car.
Right.
They have that kind of power in them because the mother's love is inside of them. So the era we're going to is not going to be leaders who have competition or power or strength, which was the past, but the era we're going to is going to be leaders who are able to show this kind of absolute love. And for men, they will have to learn the act of humility. They've been in power for a long time now, and now they'll have to show humility.
Or, you know, we've said on some of shows, you know, men go from the warrior archetype maybe to the protector archetype. You know, that's, you know, kind of another way to look at it, perhaps.
Well, I mean, it's not a complete concept, this. It's more complete to say that the era we're going into is about enlightenment. It's about the time where people can actually reach enlightenment. Up to now, people have talked about enlightenment in terms of books, or maybe there was one enlightened person, everyone sort of listened to what they have to say. But now, actually, is the era where people can actually go inside themselves and reach and experience enlightenment themselves. But that is going to be through the breathing. That's what the other thing that says, this breathing, getting this breathing around the world is the most important thing, because people need to realize that they can touch into the universe, which is inside of them, not outside of them, but they have to learn how to breathe.
Well, how are you going to teach that? I mean, you're only one person. How are you spreading this? Because apparently it's got to be a specific technique, correct?
Right. Well, I've worked with a person in Marshall Masters. He's also written many books about 2012, which are very good. And he also talks about the preparation methods for the scenarios that are to come. And so we've worked together, and we're in the process. We filmed the video, and now we're in the editing process. It'll be out around mid-May or end of May. And in that video is all the methods, the exercises and the breathing methods to do the dungeon breathing, and we're going to get that viral. It's going to be all over the Internet, and it's going to go global. So that's our contribution to the world right now, is to get this breathing and the basic exercises, a complete comprehensive package. It's amazing. The understanding of these exercises have been done for thousands of years. I mean, just for example, we say the neck, and someone rolls their neck, and it's so simple. just by rolling the neck, you can feel if you have any pain in the neck. But the neck is not just the neck. The neck is actually connected to your liver. So if we know you have a problem with the neck, we know you have a problem with the liver. But not only that, the neck is also the liver, which is also anger and hope. So someone with a really big neck has incredible hope and positive attitude. Someone with a very small neck that's not so positive, not so hopeful, or maybe it's got a lot of anger inside them. So we can see everything about yourself in order to internalize and heal yourself just through knowing five basic exercises and rotating the muscles.
Well, that must be interesting for you. And as you're saying that about the neck, I couldn't help it, but I got this flash of Rush Limbaugh in front of me.
Why Rush Limbaugh?
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm thinking he said something about a neck, you know, and he's this big guy. And you know, and I'm thinking, you know, he's got a huge neck, and I'm thinking I don't think of him as a hopeful guy.
he's positive and hopeful, but obviously takes it in a different direction as well.
Well, maybe so. So Roar, this I'm you know, why do you, well, all right, so you say we have a little bit more trouble wrapping our mind around this in the West, and to a certain extent I understand that, because I consider myself a very open-minded person, and I'm letting myself get too hung up on the how-to, the methodology. But when you say, you know, you've gotten these messages from these cosmic beings, I mean, have you seen them, or are these the messages from the plants or the trees or the water or the air? I mean, more on that, if you would elaborate.
Okay. Okay. So in the West, you have something called channeling, and well, it's everywhere in the world. And channeling basically, some cosmic being or some being decides that I need to get this message down to the earth, and they choose you, and then they start speaking to you out of the blue.
Okay.
And they give you a message, and they say, sit down and write this. That's basically how channeling works in general.
Right. Okay.
The Eastern, where I've been doing training, that concept there is a little bit different in that you train your body to lower your wavelength frequencies through breathing training so that at some level you can match the same frequency as that. And then on an equal level, like having a cup of coffee, you sit down, you have a cup of coffee with, you know, in my case it was Marlin from the Pleiades, and you have a cup of coffee and you say, Marlin, you ask questions and he gives answers. And in that way, you can ask questions and receive answers. So it's not just a one-way street, it's actually two ways.
So I guess where I got confused was because you were saying that the plants talk, but that's sort of a different conversation than the channeling, right?
Well, it's the same thing in the sense that I can go to, for example, the dandelion plant sitting right in front of me. I could say, you know, I would like to speak to the representative of dandelion planets on the earth. And so I speak to the soul who's in charge of that, because the soul who's in charge of that is going to know all of the principles at that level of the universe and can answer any question about the earth. If I just ask the dandelion plant in front of me, how are you feeling? It's going to say, well, good. That is all. It has no understanding of the principles that you would want to ask about. But if you ask to the representative god of that planet or that plant, then you can have their viewpoint at their level, which is only up to a certain level, about any question you want to ask about the earth. So it's possible through breathing, through lowering your wavelengths and reaching that level. These are original abilities that all of us had. And then when you have the conversation, you look and you look what you've written, and you have an idea that there's truth to it, there's essence to it.
Okay. Well, so are we going to have to worry about money and 401ks and all of that sort of stuff in the next few years, or is money and wealth and all of these sorts of assets going to come less and less significant?
Okay. Let me just in practical terms, let me say some simple things that we can do. First of all, we need to make sure that we are healthy for anything that's coming. So we need to make sure that we have a healthy body. We need to really take care of our body. So I also do something called the 8 body types you mentioned in the beginning. We found out that at birth, there people have their own body types. They're different, the foods they eat and stuff, depending on the size of their organs. The people contact me, I can let them know that information. I'm giving lectures or through Skype letting people know that. It's important to know your body type, to know what foods. Some people need to eat meat, some people need vegetables, some people need roots, some people need leaves. The vitamins of each are going to be different. But first of all, think of what your body needs. And if you need to exercise, if you need to walk, you really need to take care of your health first and foremost. You have to have a strong immune system for what's coming. The second thing is you have to make sure that your heart is open. So you have to make sure that the heart is wider and expanded, just not just in your local area, but expand it to your community and to the whole earth. So start out by loving yourself. Loving yourself means that, A, we are all born imbalanced. All of us are here to learn something. We have something that's too strong and something that's too weak. And whatever's too strong, we need to let go of that. If we have too much pride or something, then we let go of that. But if we have something that's too weak, then we need to fill that up, whether it's, you know, lack of planning skills or lack of confidence. We need to get that. So we're all perfectly perfect or perfectly imbalanced. So we just accept ourselves for who we are. And second, we must remember that we are all precious beings. And this is what the cosmic beings say again and again. We are all so precious to be here right now. It's so hard to get a visa to come to the earth. But you have to be very passionate to come here. And all of you are so passionate and beautiful to want to be here. So remember you are precious. Remember you are perfect. And just keep trying your best. And so keep opening your hearts. And no matter what the Romney are doing or other politicians are saying, just respect them for who they are. But don't get emotional about whatever their comments are, because it's not so important.
Okay.
So we need to keep our health. We need to open our hearts. And we need to declutter. We need to declutter our attachment to material. It's very important.
Okay. Well, you know, you just said something that makes me want to ask you. Have these beings told you about any other life out there in the cosmos besides us?
Of course, that's basic. When they say they talk about expanding our love, they say, first of all, we must love ourselves and we must love our family and we must expand our love to love our neighborhood and our community and our state and then our entire world, our global community. Then we must branch out and extend our love to all of our cosmic friends out there, our cosmic beings. Like, if you go on the internet and just type in UFOs lately, UFOs are appearing every single day all across the country. They're appearing at football stadiums in America. They're appearing above buildings in Manhattan. Why are they coming right now? They're coming to tell you that we are out here. We are your friends. You know,
that's going to be part of, I mean, could that, I mean, I remember, I forget who it was. I want to say this is connected to Ronald Reagan, but I think somebody said something about the thing that would cause the Earth to become united would be if they found out there was, you know, if there was a mothership, you know, over the planet, and, you know, we would band together out of, you know, out of fear of, you know, of you know, UFOs. And I guess it makes me think, that could potentially be something that would shift people's consciousness if suddenly it was, you know, known across the globe that UFOs were actually appearing all over. I don't think the average person knows what you just said, that, you know, that UFOs have been appearing in larger numbers. I mean, I haven't heard that anywhere.
I guess, I mean, people are not really paying attention to the internet or the news, but, I mean, crop circles are the biggest news around the world, and they're unraveling these meanings behind crop circles now in Russia, and these meanings are telling, in the crop circles, telling about the events that are set to come soon. And UFOs are just appearing daily everywhere. And they appeared at an American college football game recently. In front of 50,000 people.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Really, where did that happen? What football game?
This is literally maybe 3 to 4 months ago. I think it was somewhere in Georgia or something. If you just type in football game, UFO, it should pop up. They appeared above Manhattan recently. They appeared above Seoul, South Korea.
Okay.
And that's the message. They're trying to say, we're here and we're your friends. And please love and respect us, too. We're out here. So let's expand our consciousness throughout the entire universe. And think about, which planet did you come from?
Which planet did I come from?
Perhaps you came from a planet and you came down here to... They say the Earth is a school for us to evolve and learn about, you know, evolution, to study. So it's a school.
I
we
see.
All came to evolve.
I see.
So you have to come somewhere in the universe. Where?
So, Roar, let me ask you, where does religion fit into this? Does it, I mean, have we all got it wrong with all of these different religions across the globe?
Religions are very, very helpful. They help. They're part of the stage one to stage two when people need to learn about virtue and they need to learn about goodness and how to be a good moral person and how to go in a good direction. So they're used to discipline people. There are many different ways to discipline yourself through sports, through individual spirituality, to religion. They're all very useful things. But at some point, as I said, you know, the Buddha says, at some point, you need to kick the Buddha out of the way. And at some point, you need to go down the road of independence, because the universe is independent. So every soul in the end is actually an independent soul. So at some point, when you finally fortified yourself enough, you have to. In the future, there will be no religion, but there will be a study about what they all mean. So, you know, what is knowledge? You can study what is the knowledge of Christianity, what is the knowledge of Hindus. You can study about all this because there's something to learn through them. But in the end, through breathing, you will find your own individual world you have to go through.
So you don't profess to be of a particular religion right now. You're sort of more independent than that.
In the end, there's one religion. That is, what are the principles of how the universe works? There are principles of how the universe works. Why, you know, planets are not bumping into each other. Why there's, you know, flow between planets and a certain flow between individuals and a certain flow in nature. So between human beings and nature and the universe, there's a certain flow. And that's five elements in yin and yang. And so when you see that flow, you see how the whole thing is perfect and how we're all here to grow and evolve. When you understand that, that is the understanding of how the entire system works. That is the matrix, so to say.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about earth-based spirituality, how earth-based spirituality is a little bit more in tune with the cycles of earth, and you honor the air, the fire, the water, the spirit, the above and the below. I almost wonder if that's maybe a little bit closer than, I don't know, these other religions that, that take nature out of the equation.
Well, that's exactly it. The original harmony of the earth is, that's what we're trying to, these messages we're trying to get out to them, is the original meaning of the planet was the relationship between human beings, loving and understanding human beings, loving and understanding nature, and loving and understanding the universe. So any system that's helping to understand those three and bring them into harmony, you're on the right path.
Okay. Well, what took you to Korea to begin with? What is your background, Roar?
When I was 10 years old, my father pulled me aside. I told you, my hippie father. And he said, these are the five rules of life, and I'm only going to tell you and speak to you once about life. And he said, number one, I don't know what you want to do, so you do it. Number two, I don't know where you want to go, you go. Number three, there's something called the middle way, find it. Number four, the answer isn't in religion, so don't look there. And number five, be careful of women.
Why be careful of women?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out.
It could be a big distraction. Maybe that's what it was.
I guess that's it. But the one that touched me the most, that I kept finding synchronicity, I kept finding wherever I went, was this conversation about who am I and about what is the middle way. So to find those answers, I wanted to search through meditation, breathing, and middle way was obviously taught in the East. So, and they said the place where you can find the most purest form of breathing and mind study and heart study and the middle way was South Korea, actually.
So, no, but when you say South Korea, can you be more specific? I mean, what did you, I mean, and when you say breathing, I mean, it just all sounds so vague. I mean, where did you start? I mean, what did you actually go and study?
No, I went out there sort of, I graduated college at 21, and I got a teaching job is how it started. So I went out there as a teacher, basically, teaching English. And as I was teaching English, I was studying on the side. I studied the language, so I became fluent in the language. And then I went to graduate school there. And then I started working with Asians and thought I would spread peace around the world. And then I said, well, I can't spread peace to others if I don't know who I am, because I feel empty inside. So I first must feel happy and content with myself first before I can even think of helping others. So that got me to studying about meditation, that I was doing mountains in Korea, and the Buddhist monk said, "Dunjun," very loudly, "Dunjun, Dunjun breathing." I said, "That is wonderful. What is that?" And he said, and he shook his shoulders and said, "I don't know. We don't know anymore. That used to be the method of breathing, but we don't do it here anymore." So I started to cry. I said, "Wow, thank you for your honesty as a monk and all that. So now let me leave here and find where it is." And when I came down from the mountains, I found that everywhere, just like we have karate centers and boxing centers everywhere in America, in Korea they have these dungeon breathing centers throughout the whole country. When I traveled to China, Japan, Thailand, Taiwan, they don't have them. They're only in South Korea. And it just blows you away. They have this understanding of the essence of how breathing is, and they make it so simple.
Interesting. Well, and, you know, when I think of South Korea, I mean, this is probably my own ignorance, but South Korea is sort of just in the shadow of North Korea, you know, with, you know, all of, you know, this, our horrible fear of nuclear weapons, you know, out of North Korea. You know, I don't know a whole lot about life there in South Korea, but apparently it must be different than the other Asian countries.
It's not so different, but one of the things is that it's the only country in the history that went from a donor country, that means the WTO and the OECD nations were giving, you know, food and money to these countries to grow. So in the 1960s, it was a very, very poor country, and they were receiving, it was a donor country, they were receiving money from the OECD. And then in the 1990s, they switched that around, and now they are giving money to the poor countries of the world, and they are going, or they became a member of the OECD. So that is the first time that has ever happened, and the reason that happened is because their leaders do dungeon breathing. They do dungeon breathing every day, and they have the most miraculous economic and political transformation within 20 years. It's never happened in economic history. And also they have one of the top education systems in the world. And all of that is their biggest secret, because they don't talk about the breathing. But all of their politicians and their educational elite wake up in the morning and do these basic exercises and breathing to bring them clarity, health, stamina, bring them in line with the universe, in line with their debt, and make them fulfill it in a short period of time.
So if we go on YouTube, or if we Google the breathing, which is spelled D-A-N-J-E-O-N, will we find anything yet before your movie's out?
Start researching now. You'll find information out there. You can find it also in Tan Tien as well. In the Chinese, they call it Tan Tien, T-A-N-T-I-E-N. But there's too much focus in China on the body, because China is the kind of country that thinks the body is everything. Whereas in Korea, it's much more balanced. I think the body and the mind are essential together. So in Korea's version of Danjin, it's not only about how to make the body healthy. It's about how to evolve your spirit and your mind and your conscience and your clarity and your ethics, all in one, including the mind. So it's not just the Tai Chi with the external thing. It also has to call it, but it's called the external art and internal art. And Tai Chi is an external art, where you take the energy and you send it outwards. And Danjin Bu, you must take that energy inside and store it inside and go deeper and deeper. But you should be able to find some things. I have my lectures there on YouTube, so you can listen to my lectures about Danjin Bu. I post them for free. But for now, you can watch that kind of stuff, but you need to have a teacher, and you need to watch the video to how to actually learn it.
Okay. Well, I know you've talked a lot about, the things that we have to do. We have to, we have to learn the breathing. We have to, you know, disconnect from, you know, our connection to the material world. We have to be healthy, you know, and know our body. We should be talking to the earth. Are there any other things that we should do to prepare, so that we're ready when this cleanse happens?
Well, there are certain changes depending on, not everyone wants to put things into action right away, the people who are sort of in disbelief. So live your life as you normally do, but slowly. Use the money, use the materials you need, but slowly let go of attachments to them in your mind. Realize that, just think, if I don't have energy today, if I don't have oil today, will I be okay? That is the question for you. If you're okay with that, then live your life as you want to now. But if you don't have it today, then what will happen? And will you be attached to anything that you have right now? If you really want to make some serious preparations, you should think about storing some food just in case. Storing some food somehow in case there's no energy or no oil around for a period of time, 1 to 3 years or as long as you wish to make it. You should think about, backup generators. You should think about what we call them eco-toilets. So you know how to make a toilet that's not based on that's not based on electricity.
So that's why you've been living on these eco farms.
I travel the world and I teach people how to either run an eco or the people who are running eco farms how to run it more efficiently or how to gather the people together. Making community is very important. People are going to go back to community. We started in community. I know people don't believe it, but we are going to go back to community. If things get very difficult, it can be very hard to manage the house you're in now, and you're going to have to join together with 5, 10, 20, 30 other houses around you. It's hard to imagine it's going to happen. And so it's a great for evolution being community because it helps reduce our desires, helps bring us to balance, but also it's a way that we can get through when something's very difficult without energy or oil or something.
Well, there's this show that I have watched on television recently called The Colony, where it's a test. They stage this, post-apocalyptic world where a dozen people or a few or maybe a few less are thrown together, and, they don't have much of anything to start over again. And what struck me right off the bat was the people who know how to do things, the people who know how to do things with their hands, they're going to be the people who are going to survive. The ones that know how to maybe build a generator or know how to, the guys who sit behind computers and crunch numbers, they're going to be useless,
Exactly.
It's those guys that know how to get their hands dirty and know how to, to do the basics. It's like the guy you'd want to be on a desert island with. Those are the ones that can make fire, the ones that know how to purify water. Somebody who knows how to stitch you up if you you get a huge cut. I mean, it's the basics where it feels like we should be learning in a sense because we rely way too much on our conveniences. I think we all really have to maybe think about becoming a little bit more self-sufficient.
That's exactly it. I watched that show. Someone showed it to me, and it was amazing. But when we really put our minds with what we can do and what we can come up with to survive, or different ways, different technologies to really use. So that's an amazing show. It's a great example, and that's exactly it. It's about self-sufficiency right now. It's about finding ways. We've forgotten how to get clean water and how to. Another thing that we're doing here is showing people an amazing thing you can do is how to ferment your wild plants around you. And this is very, very important. What you have growing right in your yard is wild plants, whether they're dandelions or mugworts or plantain. These wild plants contain all of the enzymes, minerals, and nutrients you need to survive a day, to live a day. They contain everything you need. So we teach people a method how to, if you just take 7 different wild plants around you, put them in a bottle and fill it up with half brown sugar, and you let it ferment for 3 months, after that, just 1 teaspoon of that is enough. It contains all the enzymes you need to survive a single day.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. Well, and to be honest with you, I don't even know what plants I have in my yard. I don't know if they would poison me or feed me. I really don't. And that's a terrible thing to say.
Different ones doesn't matter. They even the poisonous ones will be leveled off if you have 5 different ones.
Okay. Well, Roar, I have somebody here on the switchboard. Let me just see if they have a question for you. Just a moment.
Cool.
Hi, do you have a question for Roar? From the 705 area code, did you have a question?
No, I'm just listening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for listening. Well, I guess they didn't have a question. Well, Roar, just a couple more minutes till my second guest pops up on the switchboard here. Is there anything you can tell us about the 8 different body types? How do we know what body type we are?
In essence, there are eight different body types, but if we break them down to a sort of a yang body type and a yin body type, for example, do you have heat in your stomach or not have heat in your stomach is very important to know. So when you, and not now, because everyone's imbalanced now and they're not feeling well now. So how you feel now is not so important, but how you felt when maybe you were 15 or when you were 20, because that's more close to your healthy state. So at that time, if you were able to eat spicy food every day and you felt comfortable, then you would have what we call a cold stomach. So then you could eat all the spats and eat Indian body type. So that's great. You can eat all the spicy foods you want. Generally, that body type can eat lots of meats and eggs and many different varieties of stuff because they have a cold stomach. But if you're the kind of stomach who you eat one piece of pepper or something and you feel discomfort there, then you have what's called, you know, a firmness in your stomach. So you're born with a very strong stomach. And strong doesn't mean healthy or unhealthy. It just means it's strong. And so in that sense, eating anything spicy is going to add fuel to that stomach. So you need to do the opposite and eat things that are refreshing. So you need to eat, you know, cold water, ice cube water. You need to eat refreshing leaves, alkaline food. Things are going to cool off that stomach. Otherwise, everything gets stuck in the top of the body. So there's a body type called the meat to potatoes body type, which is really amazing. So they are basically the body type that controls the entire economic system. So almost all the foods that you find at the supermarkets and all that, that's made for their body type, the foods that are right for them, the foods that we sell on commercials and stuff. So, but that doesn't mean it's right for you. So in the 60s, you had the hippie revolution. You had the alternative store movement. People said, enough of this. I need to find my hemp and my spirulina and my alfalfa sprouts. Because their body type wasn't right for them. They're actually what's called the vegetarian body type. They have very strong lungs and very weak livers. So if they keep eating meat, their lungs become too strong and they can get tuberculosis or they can get some kind of lung disease in that sense. But their liver's too weak. So they need to do things only if it's right for the liver, which is what? Green vegetables, sprouts. So in order for them to survive, they said, enough of this, and I'm going to go and find the foods that are right for me. So... Okay. Now, in essence, those are two kinds. You'll find those either the heat or cold. There's a kind that one can sweat a lot, and one, if they sweat, they'll get sick.
Okay. Well, I guess, Roar, is there anything you'd like to say to listeners that I failed to ask that you think is important that they know?
I think you've asked the main question. There's a shift coming along, and I know it's easy to watch the television, and I know it's easy to not want to make changes, assume the best, and that's okay, but we really start to make a change every day. You know, first start out with see whether you're really loving yourself and make a change every day to start loving yourself, and then slowly make a change to start loving your body and then your mind, and then if you branch out, then try to think how you can prepare a little bit with you and your community about just some little things in case the energy of the oil is not there, little changes that you can make.
Okay.
And as for me, I got this video coming out next month, so please, I recommend all of you get a copy of that so you can start doing the exercises and the breathing. We do have a website that also, we have an online spiritual school that we're asking people to look at. It's called Sun, S-E-O-N, Wellbeing Academy USA. com.
Okay, so is the winter solstice in 2012? Is that a particularly fortuitous date that that we should be watching for, or is it just everything starts this year and it's not particularly at the solstice?
Things are already changing now. People are already feeling different. People are feeling very tense right now because the energy is coming down. It's forcing you to want to change. The energy is coming down, forcing you to let go of material, and attachment is here right now. And the energy is coming down to make you think about loving yourself and what your real purpose here is here now. So you're going to feel some kind of discomfort all the time throughout the year, whether it's, do I really want to be doing the job? Do I really want to be in this relationship? That kind of discomfort is going to be around you all the time till you start going into the direction that you really want to go around. So you'll feel that this year, the whole year. In terms of changes, the end of the year, it's a women and female energy is getting much, much stronger. The new era begins around the 22nd. But actually how this certain belt thing is going to come about, towards the end of the year or sometime beginning of next year, you'll start to see stage by stage some developments in that area. And hopefully you'll be strongly in your love and in your preparation by them.
Okay. Well, Roar, thank you so much for this incredible commitment you have. To teach, teach us Americans here. I mean, what a feat. So thank you for your bravery. Thank you for your commitment. And I will definitely be Googling some of these ideas you mentioned in the show, and looking forward to that film of yours, because I want to know how to do these breaths.
Well, hopefully next time in LA I can come visit you directly and teach you directly. That would be lovely.
Well, absolutely. Please do. Keep in touch, and when you're here in LA, please let me know. I'd like to attend one of your classes.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for all the work you're doing. Really lovely. I really love your positive energy.
All right. Thank you so much. Good night.
Good night. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let me just see it. Trish, is that you?
Yes, in fact, I was just hearing the rest of it. What a fascinating guest. Who was that?
Well, that was Roar Shepherd, and he has a book out called The Universe Speaks, The Love and Pain of 2012 to 2025, and it's about the shifts that are coming, you'll have to listen to the show.
Well, it sounds wonderful, and, say his name one more time.
His name is Roar, R-O-A-R, Shepherd. Shepherd.
Okay. Okay, well, good. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on the show. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm doing great. I'm doing great. And let me just introduce you to my guest, because I wasn't quite sure if you were someone calling in. I didn't recognize the phone number, so I wasn't sure if you were calling in to ask a question or if you were actually Trish.
Well, I think you've got me scheduled for about an hour this evening, and that's just fine.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad you're here with us. So listeners, Trish McCannon is with us now. I want to tell you a little bit about her, and then we're going to start talking about her book on Jesus and the mystery traditions. Trish is a renowned American clairvoyant. She's also a historian, an author, obviously, and a teacher. She's traveled the world in search of answers to the great mysteries of the ages as a dedicated researcher and mystical symbologist in many ancient paths of wisdom. She's known as the Mysteries expert. She's appeared on 175 radio and TV shows worldwide, including Coast to Coast AM, Unsolved Mysteries, Strange Universe, and a number of international documentaries. She's the author of over 30 CDs and DVDs, as well as the beloved books Dialogues with the Angels and what we're talking about tonight, Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years and the Ancient Mystery Religions. For the last 20 years or so, she's been a headliner at conferences around the world, giving soul matrix readings for over 6,000 people, and her commitment to inner awakening and world unity, which is what Roar was talking about, actually, Trisha. Her website is TrishaMcCannonSpeaks.com, TRICIAMCCANNON Speaks.com. I want to make sure we talk about what the soul matrix readings are, but I have to ask you about Jesus and the mystery traditions. I hope I'm not taking this out of order, but one of the things that's always intrigued me about Jesus was when I read this book that he and Mary Magdalene may have been practicing the mysteries of Isis and Osiris. And I'm wondering, what your thoughts are on that? Is that the direction your book goes in, or is it something else?
No, it's actually not the direction at all, but I'm certainly aware of those mysteries, the tantric mysteries of awakening the kundalini with a spiritually advanced partner. But let me just say that my book, which is Jesus, the Explosive Story of the 30 Lost Years in the Ancient Mystery Religions, which is, let's just face it, a very, very long subtitle, but if people just say Jesus by Trisha McCannon, they'll be able to find it. The focus of my book is not tantric sex, no.
I didn't mean that. I mean, I didn't necessarily mean tantric sex with Isis and Osiris. But go ahead, keep going.
Well, the focus of the book really has to do with reminding people about something most of us were not taught about, which has to do with the great spiritual mysteries and the fact that there were some very profound mystery schools all over the planet and some very high cultures for about 4,000 years before Jesus was born and some 400 years after, you know, he died and went through the resurrection. And these mystery schools actually knew about his coming and were looking forward to it. They had prophesied it some 500 years before he came in five different countries, the Celts, the Essenes, the Persian Mithrans, and the Buddhists and the Egyptians had all prophesied that he would come. So he was trained during those, you know, 30-something missing years by masters in many different chapters of what is called the Great White Brotherhood. And that's sort of an overarching term, but there were commonalities about structure, the precepts that they taught, the spiritual path of illumination that they were seeking, and the grades of initiation. So the book about Jesus is really about the mysteries. We begin with a couple of chapters teaching people basically the language of the mysteries, which is the language of Hermetics, the secret language of the soul. And the ancient sages encoded their wisdom about the knowledge of the universe and what lies behind it in these sacred Hermetic icons. And, of course, most of us know a lot about symbols because we use exoteric symbols every day, like stop signs and don't smoke and restaurant here. But these are esoteric symbols that take us into a deeper level of ourselves. That's the very nature of them. So we begin by, you know, introducing people to the mysteries and the language, and then we begin the journey of Jesus' life, and we go through his time in when was he really, really born? That's the very first thing. What was that darn star of Bethlehem? And, of course, there's a lot of opinions about whether it was a UFO or, you know, a constellation or a comet or a meteor or a conjunction in the sky. So I talk about the possibilities, and really specifically there are four major dates, two of them being Christmas Day, believe it or not, of 7 and 8 B.C., and then one being a Libra around between the 10th and the 13th, and he may very well have been a Libra, and the other being July 27th, which is a Leo. And there are many strong reasons for all this. There were documents found by the Magi that the Magi wrote in Persia, where astronomers were tracking the movements of the heavens very, very closely around that Leo date, because they expected that that would be when the king would come. So anyway, there's a section on that, a section on the Essenes and his time in Egypt as a child. And the Essenes taught angels, all about angels, angelology. Then there's a section on Britain, and I love that section. Avalon and all of the great Druid mysteries that are so beautiful and profound. And then we have a couple of chapters in India, two chapters when he was with the Buddhists for 6 years in Rajagira. And then the last section of the book is dedicated to his 7 years in the temples of ancient Egypt.
Well, now, Trish, how did you come by this knowledge? Because isn't this supposed to be a big mystery? I mean, out there in the mainstream, they claim that nobody knows what was going on the first 30 years.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, what we were taught as Christians is basically we know his birth, we know when he was 12 years old, and the next time we hear anything about him, he's getting anointed by John the Baptist, and he begins his, you know, 3-year ministry. And so, you know, most of us don't even realize, we don't even know what happened. And we assume his ministry started at 30. And the reason we did, which he didn't start at 30, it was probably between 37 and 40, maybe 42, but 37, 38, 39 are very good possibilities. The reason we've all been taught to think that he was 30 to 33 is because in the Gospel of Luke, who did not even know Jesus, Luke came in later, like when Paul came in. In the Gospel of Luke, it says, that he appeared to be a man, an attractive man around 30. And then in the Gospel of John, which actually was written by John, there's this whole passage where Jesus is talking to these Jews, and he says, before Abraham was, I am. And they say, what, man, are you crazy? You're not yet 50 years old. What are you talking about? So, you know, you might say that to a 40-year-old or a 42-year-old or a 45-year-old, but you're not going to say that to a 30-year-old. So the chances are very good he was, you know, in his late 30s, early 40s when he began his ministry. But you're right, this is a very big mystery, and it has been hidden. And I think for, you know, some politically, some very, let's say, politically self-serving reasons. And perhaps that was true in the centuries, you know, the first, whatever, 10 centuries of Christianity. Now I think people really want to know. I think there's a lot of Christians out there that are open-minded and that are more universal in scope and are looking for the truth and to try to connect the dots. And so this book has, I wound up getting access to some of the 570,000 documents hidden in the Vatican that no one's been allowed to see for over 100 years.
How did you manage that?
So that's a whole long story.
Okay. Well, first let me ask you, you know, there's some people out there that say Jesus didn't even exist because the Romans were such good record keepers and there was no record actually of Jesus. I guess you don't believe that.
Well, I don't. It's not that I don't believe it. There actually are historical records of him. Josephus, for example, the Jewish historian who, you know, wrote from the Roman palace in about 100 years. I think he was about 100 years after Jesus, something like that. And, you know, he's mentioned there, but there are other places. But I will say at a clairvoyant level, I have, like you read in the introduction, read for over 6,000 people over the course of about 30 years. And I have seen a lot of things that I never expected to see, including people who knew Jesus, people who just stood in a crowd and listened to him, people who served him food, people who traveled with him in healing.
You mean reincarnated?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I read the soul records. You had asked about that earlier. I'll just tell you a little bit about them. I've had the gift of sight since I was a little girl. When I grew up across from a big forest, and I spent a lot of time playing in the forest, and when I was about, I don't know, 7 years old, 8 years old, I started seeing these little elemental spirits in the forest. And they're like the guardian angel of the plant kingdom. And I think they were very surprised that I could see them. And after a while, you know, after a few weeks passed, they went and got this male angel who was, I guess, about 6 feet. He appeared to be about six foot tall. And he came and spoke to me, and he told me that the whole universe is structured in terms of hierarchy of function, not hierarchy like superior or inferior, but hierarchy of function. And that just as there are guardian angels for the human kingdom, there are for the plants and so forth. So he began teaching me when I was about 8 years old. So all the time I was growing up, I was having some very powerful angelic visitations, masters come and visit me in the dream state and in meditation. And when I was awake, with walking, I would take long walks at night, and when you're alone in nature under the stars, you know, you can feel those invisible presences with you, and they would walk and talk with me. So I did a lot of praying growing up that someone wiser than myself would show up that could help me connect the dots, because sometimes I would look at people and see past lives, I'd see future events, I'd see present things. But I didn't seem to have a lot of control over my gift as a child. And so I was trying to figure out where the gas pedal was and where the brake was, you know, on the gift. And when I was about 19 years old, I met a group of masters called the Viragi Masters. And Virag means truth or detachment in Sanskrit. And they teach the ancient science of soul travel, which is the ability that we all have as eternal souls to shift our consciousness and leave our bodies while we're still living in the physical world as human beings and to travel in these interdimensional planes. And this was like my kind of path. I thought, that's it, you know. I mean, not you know, find out when you die. I want to know, and I want to know now, and there's no reason I shouldn't be able to know. And the Viraghi had a roadmap to all the dimensional realms, and that was invaluable. And they had specific exercises or processes to teach you how to begin to do it yourself. And so I began working with these masters when I was 19 years old. So all during my 20s, I was a commercial advertising photographer. I was in my 20s, in my 30s, even my 40s. Very successful here in Atlanta, my straight Clark Kent life. But on an inner level, I was very much involved in traveling in these other dimensions and having many powerful experiences with all sorts of higher dimensional beings. And when I was about 30, I went to England. I was engaged to a British man, and I was meditating at Stonehenge, and everything got very still. It was a very blustery Tuesday day. I remember only like a dozen people there, and everything got very still. And I opened my eyes, and there was an angel about 30 or 40 feet from me. He was standing with his finger to his lips, and with great flourish, he deliberately moved his arm in this sweeping gesture. And I thought, what? You know, is this like a secret or something? And I broke contact with the rock, and when I did, everything went back. All the visitors that had vanished when I had opened my eyes, and the visitor center had gone, and the paved road had vanished, all of those things went back to normal, to present time, and the angel was gone. And so I didn't realize it at the time, but what had happened is he had unsealed the Akashic records for me. I had been, you know, working at sort of getting more access to them, and suddenly I found that I could read the soul records of anybody that I met. Hmm. And so my readings, you know, as it is, you know this, as someone who works in spiritual realm, spirit has a life of its own. We're just the vessel for the higher force to come through. And if we're walking a path of love and grace and light and service, then higher and higher frequencies come through us. So when I first started reading, I only went 3,000-5,000 years in the past. Then I made a leap to where I was going 20,000 years, 100,000 years. And then I found myself back in, you know, Atlantis or Lemuria. And I would sometimes see my client soul come in on a spaceship during especially the Atlantean times, where we were very much a star capital. And so then I think, well, hello, you know, where did my client come from? So I'd start pulling the thread, and I would find myself in the Pleiadian system or the Sirian system or the Orion system. And I would think, well, this is interesting. And, of course, you know, if you're there, you want to look around and see what's happening. So I started learning experientially about lives and on all these different systems. And
wow. This is incredibly interesting.
It is.
So this is how you came to know without a doubt then that Jesus was actually real.
Yes, let me just say, I guess I begin to answer your question about the soul matrix reading to tell you a little bit about my own history. But if we try to connect the story of what my experience has been with Jesus with what I've been trying to tell you about the way that spirit has chosen to operate through my particular set of gifts in this lifetime, is that, you know, as I continued to follow the thread of souls to the higher realms, I found that all of us actually are created, let's put it like that, in the angelic kingdoms. We all begin in the higher realms, and we come down as souls from the higher realms through these graduated levels of light, deepening light into the third dimension. And, you know, really the masters teach that the three purest ways we can know God are love and sound and light. So during
What was the second one? Love?
Love, sound, and light. In the beginning was the word. Here's the vibrational sound that creates everything. And it creates a vibrational template, which was called the Logos within the ancient mysteries. And Jesus and Thoth and Horus were three of the only beings ever to an Isis, perhaps, to have said, to have held the Logos, to embody the Logos or the divine pattern. It's a pattern that's known as the pattern of the divine Purusha. The divine Purusha is the selfless self that permeates the universe. It's the Christ spirit. Purusha is a Sanskrit word. It comes from the East. But they also know of that divine presence. And Jesus, of course, was an incarnation of the divine Purusha, as was Buddha. As was Buddha.
Okay. I've sort of gotten a little off track here with that. I mean, that in itself is so interesting, Tricia. And I guess I can't help, I keep getting this strong feeling to say to you, just to sort of, stick my neck out there. I mean, I would love to know if you get any sort of reading, for me,
Let me just take a moment to say how my gifts work. I know that it is popular, and I've actually done shows like this, to do a show where I call up and we open the phone lines and people want to call in and ask me questions. I've done actually quite a lot of shows like that, but I that's kind of not where my focus is right now, darling.
Sure.
Really has to do
okay.
with
well, I've never done that before with a guest, and I apologize for doing it with you tonight. I just felt strongly that I was supposed to ask you, but let's forget it and let's stick to your book. So where was Jesus before the age of 12, and what was he actually doing, and tell us about those wise men. Who were they really?
Well, most of us know from the Bible that there were three wise men or three magi, but actually there were four. They came from the four directions, north, south, east, and west. One was definitely Egypt. One was probably Indian, far from the Far East. One was probably Persian, and one was Celtic. But only three made it. So the fourth one may have been caught in a storm, but there were actually four lights. The accounts from the Essenes at that time were that there were four lights that appeared in the heaven, and they came together and merged to make one really bright light that shined a beam of light down. And they actually said that the stories were that the soul of Jesus descended in this beam of light. That's a wild concept, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yes, so the Magi were definitely part of it. And, I mean, there's a lot to say about Jesus. And this book has over 100 illustrations in it and over 1,200 footnotes. And it took me about 3 years to write it. So it's one that really, I think, has been encoded with vibrational frequencies by the masters who were working with me. If you wouldn't mind, and if we have time, I'd like to just tell you exactly, if you're interested, in why I wrote that book and how I came to be asked by the spiritual forces to write it. Is that
sure.
something you would like to hear?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I want to hear more about Jesus' story, but I'd like to hear that as well.
Well, I was writing a book actually called Decoding the Mysteries of the Ages, and the subtitle was The Secret Teachings of Jesus, Isis, Horus, and the Masters of the Far East, which is a pretty broad subject, to be honest with you. And I had written this larger book, and I had three chapters on Jesus in it, and as I continued to write, I kept adding a little more and a little more. Before I knew it, I had 200 pages on Jesus, and I have now a 600-page book, which was way too big for the publisher, and so I thought, what to do? And so I decided I would just pull the 200 pages on Jesus out of the book. And, I teach the mysteries, and, I have several other books published, so I thought this would solve my problem. Well, obviously, Jesus or the great spiritual hierarchy had another idea altogether. So it was Christmas. It was that week after Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's, where everything's kind of quiet, and you're in the cave time, and, you're not seeing clients. And I had just decided to do this, so I laid down on the floor of my office rug, and I put my hand over my eyes, And I became aware after a few minutes of this incredibly bright light coming in through my arm. And I moved my arm, and Jesus was standing in the room in front of me. And he was all golden. And there was none of this suffering stuff we hear about, you know, on the cross. He was so joyous and so full of light and love. He just opened your heart immediately with his presence. And he said without any preamble, he said telepathically, I want you to write a book about my lost years and secret teachings. There has been enough war and bloodshed in my name. And, of course, I was stunned. And I think the first thought that went through my head was, well, can I finish this other book first? And, you know, we're so funny and so human. And he laughed and waved his hand like, don't worry, it'll just take a moment. And I'll open every door. And, of course, I had no idea his moment would be 3 years of my life, but okay, you know, it's a little, they count time a little differently up there in heaven, I guess. And so it took me about 15 minutes of sort of laying there and thinking of all the reasons why I shouldn't write a book on Jesus and how, I mean, after all, he had incarnated among the Romans and the Jews, which at that time were very dense in consciousness, probably the two densest groups on the planet. Not that there weren't enlightened Jews in Egypt and some other places, but the Pharisees and Sadducees at that time had, you know, kind of were more dogma than true spiritual inspiration. And so I finally said yes, and it took me about 6 months to lay out the research, which I created a whole series of gorgeous videos on the Egyptian mysteries, the Jewish mysteries, and the Christian mysteries, and the true inner meanings behind them. And then I went on to create a whole series on the great mysteries. And about 6 months later, because I organize everything visually since I'm a clairvoyant, I began the book. And I had people show up at my house with rare documents. I had people send me in the mail things that you would normally never be able to get. I had books materialized on my bookcase. So it was quite a journey to write the book and to be in the presence of so many miracles. About 3 months after I was writing, I had a couple of friends come with their little 5-year-old adopted daughter to my house to spend the night. They were in from Central America. And we put the little girl to bed in the room where I had been sleeping during the time I had been writing this book and all these masters had been coming. And the next morning when we got up to go to breakfast, I gave this little girl this wonderful teddy bear I bought for her. And I said, now you can name this little bear anything you want. And she said, Issa. And I said, oh, you mean Alyssa? She said, no, Issa. I said, oh, you mean Eliza? And she said, no, Issa. Well, Issa, of course, is the name Jesus used in all these different countries. That's what he was known as, Saint Issa. And so this little girl had obviously been visited in the night and had been so, you know, sensitive and perceptive that she had picked it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I would imagine then that there must have been different teachings that Jesus probably shared with his apostles that we don't ever hear about.
Yes, and actually I talk about some of them, a lot of them, in the book. That's really what the book is about. The mystery schools, you know, if you lined up the masters and the sages, the masters in the mystery schools would totally love, approve, and applaud everything that he did. And because they were very much behind it. Now, he was, of course, his own being, his own person. But, you know, I'm sure in those higher spiritual councils, those masters aren't arguing with one another like we are down here, squabbling about religion and politics.
So what, I mean, you know, there's so much out there about, you know, was he married to Mary Magdalene and, you know, his different attitudes about women compared to other men of his day. Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Yeah, there's all these passages of what he did say about women. He said, honor your mother, for she is the giver of your life. You know, she holds you, feeds you, takes care of you. and gives you all of her energy, and take care of your daughters and your sisters. He talks about how women are really the light of the world, who have the power to inspire men's hearts. So he was a great champion of women, and really someone of great balance in all of his thinking, you know, a heart, mind, body, spirit, male, female. That's part of the whole process of mastery is balancing all of those things.
And was he married to Mary Magdalene?
Well, let me say that there are a couple of places where it's possible this could have taken place. When he came back from India and Rajagira with the Buddhist to Israel, about 27, from 27 to 30, he was back in his own homeland. And he was very close to Lazarus and Mary and Martha at that time. Lazarus and he used to lay out on the roof at night and when it was cooler and look at the stars and talk. And Mary would crawl up there and listen to them. So she was probably more like a girl of, 17, 18, 19. He would have been about 27. So that was probably about their age difference. That this is Mary Bethany, who I believe was also Mary the Magdala or Mary the Great, which is what Mary, we've slanged it to Mary Magdalene. So there was 3 years there, and then he goes to Britain at age 30. And he could have been there 6 months, even a year, but why would he go? He had already studied with the Druids. There are two reasons. One, he was returning to his friends and early masters after he graduated from the Essenes at age 13, and he went to study with the Druids at 14 and 15 before going to India. There was that. But it's very likely that he took Mary with him and that they married and had a child at that time. There are accounts of Mary with a boy named Jesus traveling in the Outer Hebrides Islands up near Scotland. Now, that could have been Mary, his mother, and Jesus that we know of, but that's doubtful because he was there with his uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, Mary and himself when he was about seven, but they would have all been together, and they wouldn't have been up in Scotland. They would have been in England and Britain, where Joseph of Arimathea had his 10 mines in the Castorati Mountains. And there were blood connections, too, because Jesus' grandmother, Mary's mother, was Anna, who was a Celtic princess or Celtic nobility.
So you don't agree with the story that, Mary had a daughter and they went to southern France, that whole story, that doesn't resonate?
Not a matter of do I agree or do I not agree, okay? I'm following the facts, and so I'm reporting to you what I've discovered about the history, the hidden history and the facts.
So, but let me just go back and forgive me if you've already answered this and maybe I just missed it. All of this information that you have that, you know, he studied with the Druids, that he went to Britain, that he was, you know, in these other places, where did you find this information that has been missing from so many researchers?
As I said, there are 1,200 footnotes and 100-page bibliography. So I pulled from literally hundreds and hundreds of documents, hidden texts, things from the Vatican, books, scholars, histories. I mean, I am a very prodigious researcher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as Jesus said, he brought to me the material that he obviously wanted, that was hard to get. So let me kind of just to stay back on your Mary Magdalene question, because, you know, you've asked me this question like four times. And you know, we started off with Mary. Did Mary and Jesus get married and, you know, have this passionate love affair? It's quite possible. So let me just try to finish answering that question, because, you know, I was trying to tell you in the historic record where the windows were. Because if you're going to have a marriage and a relationship, you have to have time together. And if he was gone the whole time, there's no time. So first off, we want to look, well, when was he present, and is there evidence that they were close?
Well, okay, and I want to hear that. But you know what I've read about his relationship with her is she was one of the women that helped finance his ministry, and you know, as you know, he went around teaching, she was part of the entourage. So would that not have provided a window for them to be together and you know, have a relationship and get married?
Yes, it certainly would have. However, when Jesus came back to do his ministry, while they may well have even been married at that point, or there could have in fact been a secret marriage, like the marriage in Cana that's spoken of in the Bible, where he
changes the water to wine, and
I'm very well aware of all of these things. So yes, it's possible, but He was a person that was on a very deep mission. What I was trying to give you insight into is this. I've read, you know, all of the same research. In fact, 20 years ago, I took 13 women to France on a journey through the journey that Mary Magdalene made, or Mary the Magdalene, after Jesus' crucifixion, where they landed at Rennes-le-Château or at Sainte Marie de la Mer on the beach in France, and how they went to Rennes-le-Château and Carcassonne. I know I've traveled through that whole area and taught in that area, so I'm very familiar with the history and the speculation. And I think it is quite possible, in order to continue the bloodline, that there was a marriage. But it's not going to be quite the same thing that we think of as a marriage. If he had the window from 27 to 30 and then they went to England, that's one possibility for a place that they could have gone to have married and been away from the politics, to have had some time, 6 months, a year, to be really normal people together without the pressures of what was coming for Jesus. Then Jesus disappears for 7 years in the temples of Egypt. It is also possible that Mary went and studied at that time, or even a few years after he did, where they were in Egypt at the same time, and they would have both have been trained in those mysteries. I suspect that that's probably true, but remember, she was about 10 years younger than he was. So then we return to events around the time of the Bible. So that means that they could have actually had a formal ceremony, that the only thing recorded is the one in Cana. It could have been a secret ceremony within the order of the Magdalenes, because the classic archetype was that the goddess marries the archetype of the Savior Lord, whose blood is spilled into the earth to regenerate the earth and create annual renewal.
The dying rising king.
This muse, you know, mythology, muse and musi, and, you know, Adonis, all of these, Osiris, you know, all of these earlier incarnations of the, right, the king that must die to be reborn, which is the phoenix. So he was very well aware of his mission. So even if they had decided that they were going to get married, maybe they met, they cared for each other, they didn't get married, they're both at the temples, they decide to bring this kind of holy union together. I also am aware that the legends, some of the legends are that there was a girl. Some say she was a black slave, some say she was a daughter or an adopted daughter of Mary. She could have been a first child. She could have been a second child if they had had a child earlier. There's much to speculate on, but this is the thing that we, until there's a little more research, we can't know. You know what I'm saying? We can speculate, we can believe, we can have an opinion. And there are holes where it's certainly possible. But I guess the book that I sought to write was a book that would be based in history. And you can put forth a hypothesis, but you have to have the facts to back it up.
So aside from what you've told us, what do you think would be the most provocative or interesting or controversial things you discovered that really aren't in sync with, you know, the mainstream telling of Jesus?
Gosh, well, we certainly have spoken about some of them, the age for when he started his ministry, the fact that he didn't just stay as a poor carpenter in Galilee for 30 years. You know, certainly I think in the last 20 years, people have begun to know that he was in India, because there have been some wonderful writers who've brought that information forth. But there really haven't been any writers that have done a detailed, thorough search of all of these other lands. There's some wonderful British writers that have chronicled Jesus in England, but they don't know about the rest of the picture. So, and I think that one of the things that marks this as such a sort of unique project is that it is teaching spiritual mysteries that are as accessible to us today as they were in the past. We just have forgotten them.
What are they, Tricia?
Wow, I think that's a whole nother radio show, darling.
Well, you can just give us a couple sound bites, right?
Well, a sound bite on the mysteries. Goodness gracious. Well, I can say that the chief objective of the mysteries was that they taught that there was one divine presence behind everything, and that this divine presence was so immense that it had to step itself down in successive increments or octaves of light and sound and vibration in order for this world to even come into being, that there is an immortal and sacred self within each one of us, and that this never dies, that we're down here in a world of experience, that there's certain lessons that we have to learn that have to do with compassion and self-worth and love of others and love of self. It's a balance. It's really a balance, the process of mastery. So the mysteries were about teaching about the divinity within each one of us and how to basically open up your life as a vessel to bring more light into it. And in that way, you become a healing agent for those around you.
Well, you know, a lot of the phrases you're using remind me of what they teach in Kabbalah. I'm wondering if that had any influence on this or vice versa.
Well, the mysteries created the Kabbalah. The Kabbalah was not just created, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. The Hebrews were led when they left Egypt by Moses, who was raised as a prince of Egypt and trained in the temples of Heliopolis, the city of the sun in Egypt. And so he was very deeply aware of the mysteries because he was an initiate himself. That's why he carried that serpent staff. So what did he teach? What did he encode? The mysteries of Moses. They were the Egyptian mysteries. And of course, you know, they were woven with also a knowledge of Hebrew. But the Egyptian mysteries understood. I mean, that's actually what the tarot comes from, the word rotar, or the wheel of space and time, the wheel of Abagawa, and the wheel of reincarnation, life and death and rebirth. So, you know, the mysteries are deep. They're something you can study for many, many, many lifetimes. There's no end to them.
I'm getting an email from a listener who wants me to ask you, does the mysteries of Isis or the goddess Isis play into the story any kind of way?
Yes, very, very much. Isis is the I Am principle of the Divine Mother. And, the mysteries taught that the Divine Feminine, the Divine Mother, comes into the world again and again and again. That's why she was known as She of 10,000 Names and 10,000 Faces. And Isis really epitomizes all of them because she was a wife, she was a mother, she was a daughter, she was a queen, she was a refugee, she was a medicine woman, she was a healer, she was a civilization builder. If you ever read her titles, it's like the maker of the first sail, builder of the first temples, instigator of marriage, ender of cannibalism. I mean, she was a...
Right, her ordeology is pretty extensive.
She's amazing. And so, yes, Isis, within the mysteries, they believed that nature, that the beauty that we experience in nature, were the veils of Isis. And that as we pulled back the mysteries and began to decode the mysteries of nature, we begin to have a glimpse of the pattern behind everything. So, for example, we can notice that the galaxy reflects the solar system, and the solar system reflects the atoms in our body, the microcosm and the macrocosm, as above, so below, as below, so above. That's one of the seven hermetic maxims of hermetic law, hermetic truth, that we reflect the heavens. And the ancient cultures deliberately built cities and architecture and temples and so forth to deliberately play into this. They would create temples in the shapes or the directions of stars in the heavens, constellations. Like, for example, the three pyramids of Giza are like the belt of Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And in this way, they help to harness the celestial energy of the universe and bring it down and ground it into the earth for the purpose of healing the earth.
And is it the same reason why you get at so many of these, like Stonehenge or Newgrange, these places that the light shines through just perfectly at the solstices?
You're absolutely right. These places were about capturing energy. And there are, if you could see them at an energetic level, there are these, let's say, almost like fire ropes that go from those places to the sun. And the sun sends down energy in order to, it's like acupuncture points, help the earth, you know, heal the earth.
So we're starting to run short on time. Is there anything about Jesus' death that's different than the typical story?
Well, the thing I think that would be important to maybe share is that all of the great mystery schools taught of seven different energy bodies, but in Egypt they taught of nine. This is why Jesus had to go to Egypt to study, because it was the mastery of those last two bodies that allowed him, when it came time for him to basically go through the crucifixion and die, to dematerialize his body, which is what the Shroud of Turin is, where this image is burned in light on the shroud, and to rematerialize his body and to reconstitute it, not only in the old form, but in any form he wished, because if you read the apocryphal Gospels, you discover that some of the apostles saw him later as an old man. They saw him as a boy. They saw him as a man about the same age as Jesus, who walked with them to a village, and they realized by the time they got there that it was Jesus that was with them. But his appearance had changed, because the very mastery of those last two bodies allowed him to be able to actually do what we talk about in Christianity. And let me say, I my dad was a lawyer, so I tend to be sort of open-minded but skeptical. So I haven't just sort of bought Christian theology, just because I was trained in it. I think that I've always felt the power and the beauty and the presence of what Jesus is and what he represented and so forth. But I'd never gone to the level of, let us say, grounded historical perception that this book took me through. And I realized in passages in the Bible, in the New Testament, when Jesus says, I lay down my life, no one takes it from me, and I take my life back. I have the power to take it back again. He's telling us, really, if we understood who he was in terms of his spiritual mastery, that he has mastered those additional bodies and that he's literally able to die and come back.
And just real quickly, because, like I said, we're running short on time, I would think from everything you've said, Jesus would probably be pretty upset with the religion that we have on the planet in his name, which has turned into something that more about Paul than really was about Jesus.
Yes.
Or,
I think that there, first, I want to say I think that there's many wonderful people in Christianity, as well as probably every other spiritual religion on this planet or path. But we all know that what happens is you have the sage or the mystic or the master who comes down to bring the message or has the vision, like Muhammad wasn't a master. He just had a vision and a visitation, okay, and he did the best he could to, you know, keep up with it afterwards. But what happens is a lot of times the people around them don't understand, and in subsequent generations, those people don't understand, and it gets turned into dogma. And dogma creates a lot of rules and regulations, and it kind of creates a club. If you don't belong to my club, you're, you know, damned to all eternity. That's all there is to it. You'll go to hell, and, you know, you'll die in the flames of Hara. You know, and this is not really a very good message. I don't think that the message that Jesus ever intended to convey. I think he understood that the path of mastery is, they called it the way. Buddha called it the middle way, so it was called it the ancient way. It was called the way because it was a specific path that went through the heart.
And do you have any thoughts about if he intended Mary to lead his you know, to continue his legacy?
I think that since he called her the one who knew the all, he certainly felt that she had more mastery and more presence and more wisdom than any of the others in his circle. And I do think that that was the intention for many reasons. You know, each one of the astrological ages has a different masculine or feminine dominant energy. And Aries was masculine dominant. Pisces was meant to reverse and to go feminine dominant. But actually, because of the patriarchy, Roman Church and the Jews, we wound up for the last 2,000 years with a masculine dominant, masculine subdominant cultural current. And consequently, we had the annihilation of about 1,000 years of people. Including, they say, 5 to 9 million women. And that doesn't count all the incredible knights and men and Knights Templars and people who were trying to balance the field and honor the divine feminine or the goddess. You know, the god or the divine has a masculine face and a feminine face. It is ultimately beyond any gender. But its first act of splitting itself was to become the God the Father and God the Mother.
Okay.
And they are, you know, we've been in an age where only God the Father has been honored and has created great imbalance on our planet.
Absolutely. Well, Trish, we are just about out of time here, so I want to thank you very much for your time tonight. And if you want to give your website.
Thanks so much. Yes. It's Tricia McCannon, www.tricia, T-R-I-C-I-A. McCannon, M-C-C-A-N-N-O-N, just like it sounds, Matt Cannon, speaks, S-P-E-A-K-S, .com. And it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I hope next time we get a chance to speak for a few minutes before the show and just kind of get to know each other. I think you sound like a fascinating person.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Trish. I appreciate it. And, yeah, next time I'll have you on as my first guest, and we'll have a little chance to chat before we actually go on the air.
Hi.
So thank you, listeners, for tuning in tonight, and be with me next Tuesday, yes, on a special day, because I'm attending a talk on Eros at the Getty Museum Thursday night as part of their Visiting Aphrodite exhibit. And on Tuesday, I'll have Berut Regine talking about our book, Iron Butterflies, Women Transforming Themselves in the World, followed by Lydia Rule paying tribute to the work of a foremother who has passed away, Ash Fidel Long. Then coming later in April, we're going to have Barbara Walker on the show talking about the morality of the Bible, and Barbara Marks Hubbard discussing her new book, Emergence. So good night, all, and may Goddess embrace you. May Goddess embrace you and her golden wings.